Are you sure you want to stay here? It looks creepy.
But Savannah, this is the House of Mystery. Let's see, the brochure says true crime, conspiracy, alternate history, all rooms right here in the house.
I don't know, which room is ours?
Yes, this may be our room. Oh, well, sorry, ma'am. Obviously, this is not our room.
Ah, here's our room. True crime.
You've now entered the House of Mystery on KYAH. Utah's Talk Authority with your hosts, Al Warren and Kev Thompson. Also, Julie Saville with the Paranormal Report. The True Crime Commentary by Stephen David Lampley. And Dr. Joseph Usensky's Conspiracy Countdown.
And welcome back to the House of Mystery on KKNW 1150 AM Seattle. I'm Al Warren. Kev Thompson is still out sick. Now, today we have a returning guest, as well as a guest of someone that he helped write a book about. So, Ken Klonsky is the author, and our other guest is David McCullum. He wrote the book Freeing David McCullum. Thanks for being here, Ken.
Hi, Al.
Hey, and David McCullum, thank you for being on the show.
Wow, thanks, Al. Thanks for having me.
That's great. Wow. So that's quite the life you've lived, David. So let's talk about what happened to you and what was your experience when you were 16 years old, if I'm right. And
yes, that's correct. Yes.
Yeah, and you and a friend of yours, Willie Stuckley, were, I guess, arrested and charged with the killing of Nathan Blenner. So this is 1985. So take us back there and what you were doing in the area, and how this happened to get you arrested.
So on about the time of October 27th, 1985, I was simply doing what just teenagers in my particular community did, was kind of hang out around game rooms with my family. I mean, with my friends and so forth. You know, so just doing typical teenager things, like hanging out in the game rooms and playing with my friends and that sort of thing. So during that particular time, I can remember, distinctively, that's exactly what I was doing, because that's what most kids in my neighborhood actually did, at that time. So I remember that very vividly.
Yeah, yeah. And this is New York you were living in, right?
That's correct, yes.
Okay. So how did you know the guy, the victim, Nathan Blenner, at all?
No, I did not.
So what drew the police to you?
Well, I would assume, it was based on two older individuals in my neighborhood who were known to, commit crimes in and around New York City area, particularly in the Queens area. So when they committed a crime in Queens and was eventually arrested for it, during that time that, the case was being investigated, the case of Nathan Blenner's death was being investigated, it was asked questions about who they may or may not know in the neighborhood, who may know something about, or may who even been involved in the case. So the name Willie Stuckey came up at that particular time, and that's what led them to Willie Stuckey, which eventually did to my arrest.
And so you and Willie were pretty good friends then, or?
No, yes, we were. We were really good friends. We were around the same age, obviously, and we went to the same school, for example, and, we were really pretty good friends then, yes.
Yeah. So when you first got questioned for this, it must have really surprised you.
Well, actually, yeah, absolutely. I was actually shocked at the time because I knew the fact that I was being accused of committing a crime that I commit, and the being accused of committing a crime of murder, which I have never done in my entire life, I was stunned and disbelief, because I knew, based on the circumstances in terms of what the detectives were explaining, what the police were explaining to me about when this crime occurred, and all this kind of different thing. Knowing, first of all, that they didn't commit the crime, but also knowing that when they said the time of this crime was being committed, was said to be being committed, I was actually somewhere else in New York City during the time, so I actually had a legitimate alibi defense, at least in my opinion. And, unfortunately, that, of course, didn't bear out in court later on, but that's exactly what I was doing. I was actually someplace else in New York City, when this crime was said to have been committed.
Okay, so how did it get to where you confessed and falsified?
Well, yeah, so what happened in this particular case is once Willie Stuckey, of course, was arrested on October 27, 1985, around, I would say, 7:30 p.m., he was taken down to the police station and asked about this crime. So as he's being interrogated about this crime, Mr. Stuckey, that is, he said that he was actually with me when this crime was said to have been committed. And as a result, that's what led the police to eventually arrest me. But prior to Willie Stuckey, during Willie Stuckey's interrogation, he would say details about the crime in terms of how this crime was supposed to have been committed. And he sort of repeated some of the things that the police officers told him during their, during their investigation. And as a result, he was actually forced to make a confession implicating me as actually the shooter in the crime.
Wow. So what was your place in this then when you heard this and stuff? So did you just go along with the confession then, or?
No, actually, I did not. When I initially heard, in terms of what the police officer, just at the time, police officer Joseph Buddha was explaining to me, I already knew that I could commit a crime. And I actually knew that Willie Stuckey didn't commit a crime, too, because, again, during the time that they said this crime was said to have been committed, Willie Stuckey and I both was actually in the same area, during the time of this supposedly crime, at the time it was committed. So I already knew that this information was, I guess, false.
Yeah, and so what kind of help did you have? Did you have a lawyer at the time?
Well, initially, no. I think in New York City, what happens in New York City is when you can't afford an attorney, which I was clearly in that particular situation, couldn't afford an attorney. Okay. I was assigned a court-appointed attorney. Yes.
Yeah, and so you actually got brought to trial, and got convicted of the crime.
Yes, that's correct. I was actually convicted of all the crime of murder in second degree, and of course the adjoining offenses that I was actually charged and actually convicted of too. Yes, it was eventually sentenced to 25 years to life in prison.
Wow. And so how long did you actually spend in prison totally?
Well, I spent a total of 29 years. Well, actually, to be more frank, I spent actually approximately 28 and a half years in prison.
Wow. And so now that it's all happened and passed, did you ever think that you were going to get out? Like, is this kind of, did you just put yourself as being in there for the rest of your life, or?
Well, initially, and for a long time perhaps, I, leaned on the fact that my mom was a very positive person, but at the same time, I knew, at least in the back of my mind, that it was a distinct possibility that I could actually spend the rest of my life in prison if things don't go the way I expected them to go. So there were times, and I will say many times over the course of 20 and a half years, that I actually thought that I would spend the rest of my life in prison, yes.
So how did you get out, in a sense of what was the first moves that happened for you that was going to lead you out of prison?
Well, for me, first of all, in New York State, you afforded the right to appeal your particular case, after conviction. So when my state and federal appeals were exhausted, I would say in 1993, what I decided to do was write a letter writing campaign. And during that letter writing campaign, I decided to write various people. So whether it be, news agencies, various news media outlets and that sort of thing. So once I was able to do that, and I would say I wrote approximately 600-plus letters in that particular case. So, for example, some cases I would write, let's say the Daily News, I would write law firms, and I would write them more than once. I would write them maybe once, twice, three, four times if need be, because, you know, in my particular situation, I was not willing to take no for an answer. So I was willing to force the issue at least as best as I could. But I wanted to explore every opportunity and every option I could under my circumstances. So what happened was once my, state and federal appeals were exhausted, I was beginning this letter writing campaign. And this letter writing campaign lasted for a number of years, obviously, and which eventually led me to my first a magazine that I was actually reading in prison called The Sun. And in this Sun magazine, I came across an interview with Ken Konski and Reuben Hurricane Carter. So, of course, I knew who Reuben was, you know, being a former prize fighter and that sort of thing, and having spent a number of years in prison himself for a crime he didn't commit in, you know, Paterson, New Jersey. So, you know, what happened was I decided to write the Sun magazine an article and letter, let them know, look, I'd like to get in contact with Reuben. You know, so what they said to me was, look, we can't give you his personal contact information. What we can do is we can forward some letter on to Mr. Konski, which I assume they did. And once they did that, Mr. Konski wrote me back about, let's say, a week and a half later on, letting me know that, you know, he was touched by my letter and some of the things I had to say. And, you know, once he was able to do that, and I was able to communicate with Ken on a number of levels, Ken said that he would, forward my letter on to Reuben to see how he would, you know, accept the letter, which he did. So once that process took place, eventually what led to that is a communication with Reuben, you know, and, of course, the case sort of catapulted from there.
Before you came across Ken Konski, what was the type of reactions you were getting from people that you were writing letters to?
Well, in New York State, for example, this is very typical of New York State. So I was getting, for example, law firms. Mr. McCallum, you know, we understand your situation. We hear what you're saying, but unfortunately, we don't have the resources to take on your case right now. And, you know, initially, I was very upset about that particular response because I felt like people were not being totally honest with me about that. But at the same time, I understood because not only someone like me who are writing letters, you know, day in and day out. I'm sure there were many other inmates in prison who were writing letters to these particular firms and agencies as well. So it was very, very difficult for me to take, and I truly understood that. But at the same time, you know, I wasn't going to take no for an answer. So when I eventually, started making adjustments in my responses and sort of maturing that particular level, I decided to just say, you know what, I'm going to continue to move on. No is no, but I have to take no as a yes. Which means it inspired me to continue to fight for what I ultimately believed in, which is the innocence of Willie Stuckey and I.
That's pretty amazing to have that kind of, get up and go, like to keep on going, because you've got to have a lot of, there's a lot of rejection involved in this.
Oh, no question. I mean, look, when you write over, let's say, 600-plus letters or so, on a daily basis, when you're being told no, it hurts. It hurts. But at the same time, and then again, initially I struggled with the answer no, the response no. I really struggled with that. But then I started to understand, everybody's not going to be what you expect them to be. So what can I do differently during the course of my maturation and writing letters? What can I say differently, or how can I compose my letters differently to help people understand my plight? And as time went on, I think I've made adjustments to my particular letters, and look, not that I was being untruthful prior to, but I felt like I needed to make adjustments, and maybe I wasn't conveying my message clear enough. So I started looking at myself, too, in terms of what I could and couldn't do, and in terms of what I could and wouldn't say to people. Because at the very end, I just wanted to be totally honest with whoever read any of my letters. I wanted to be totally upfront with them about everything, because in my position, I felt like I had nothing to hide. So I wanted to be totally honest with everybody in that particular situation, and I felt like I was. And I was really satisfied with my letters, even though, for the most part, I was told no. I felt okay with that, only because I knew that I was being totally upfront with everything that I had to share with them.
Yeah. I could just imagine the overall, it would be very, very negative toward overall, it would be a down sort of thing. Yeah. Now, Ken, from your point, how did you first get involved in the case?
As David said, he wrote a letter to me. I was at that point with Reuben Carter, and he was on the verge of leaving the Association in Defense of the Wrongly Convicted. And so when I got this letter, I sent it over to Reuben, and I asked him what he felt in terms of David, because Reuben had worked with, at least 20 exonerations. He had an enormously successful record in Canada. And this was a U.S. case. It wasn't his first U.S. case by any means, but this would have been his first case that he initiated. And so he read David's letter, and he was intrigued by it. And he felt like we needed to meet David and make some kind of decision based on the way he felt about him. It wasn't simply that Reuben would pick up a case out of nowhere because he felt like the person was innocent. Innocence was half the issue. The other half was character. Reuben didn't want to represent somebody who might come out of prison and because he's been destroyed or ruined in some way by having been inside the prison, come out and commit a crime, even though that person was innocent of the original crime. So Reuben had to know and feel that David was somebody who would represent the wrongly convicted. And not, again, when a wrongly convicted person comes out and commits another crime, it's a serious matter. It doesn't happen that often, but when it does happen, it discredits a lot of other wrongly convicted people. So that's where I got involved in assessing whether Reuben would be willing to work with David.
Now from that point, and you guys decide to meet David, and you guys decide that it's a case that you would take on. What's involved with that? Like, what is it that you guys do at that point?
We have to look at the case, and David was spectacularly organized. He had materials that were date sensitive and trial transcripts, police reports, and you have to go through every page of the trial transcripts and the police reports. Those are the main documents that you're dealing with. So I would say it took us close to a year to really feel like we even knew half of that trial transcript, because every time you read it, and even now, here we are, David's been out of prison now for 3.5 years, even now I pick up and occasionally I see a bit of the trial transcript and I say to myself, now that's something I don't remember. So there's a lot of stuff in a transcript that you don't see because you don't have the context. You can read the words, but you don't know how they're being played out in a courtroom. So that's why you need the police reports and the anecdotal stuff to put all of that together and make some kind of alternative narrative to the one that was put forward that resulted in David and Willie's conviction. And I do want to say one thing. One of the reasons David and Willie were convicted was that in 1986, when the trial actually took place, there had been no real research done on false confessions. As we were talking about with Sebastian Burns and Atif Rafay the last time, false confessions, even in 2004, the judge wouldn't allow a false confession expert into the courtroom. Now it's very common, but back in those days, back when you talk 1986, if some jury sees a person confess to a crime, no matter how no matter how far-fetched the scenario is, and even if two people are confessing to the crime and have no relationship to each other in the way they describe it, the jury says, well, they say they did it. That's it. It's an open and shut case. We don't even have to look at the rest of the case.
Yeah,
so,
yeah. What's the turning point for that? When can you get people on board with believing in false confessions or believing that it could happen? Because it's still, even though it's presentable today and we're talking about it more, I know I still get people that roll their eyes when I tell them about a case like this. There's still a lot of, I don't want to say fight, but there's still a lot of kind of attitude. How could you confess? Like, how do we get people to believe that this happens?
Well, first of all, people who say they would never confess to a crime they didn't do haven't undergone police interrogation. Now, let's say you're an adult and you know enough to get a lawyer, because plenty of adults, all they do is sit there and tell the stories without even getting a lawyer there. But let's say you're an adult and you have some resources in terms of resisting pressure, but put yourself in the place of a pair of 16-year-old kids. The first thing a 16-year-old kid wants to do is get out of the police station. So if they're told individually, well, David, you know, if you tell us what happened, and we know that Willie really was the shooter, and you just have to tell us what happened, then you'll go home. I mean, your mom is waiting for you at home. Why wouldn't you just tell us and you can leave? And all he needs to do is start talking. And he says, well, Willie is the guy who shot him and everything, and saying that he was there. As soon as you say you were there, then you're implicated. So you're not going home. And David didn't go home for 29 years.
Yeah. Yeah, I was going to say, I think that's probably it. People just don't have the experience with the system to understand how a false confession can happen.
No, they don't.
David, how do you feel about it? How do you feel about people that say that they could never falsely confess for something they never did? How do you respond to that?
Well, you know, I think anytime someone, you know, hears a so-called confession, the first inclination is that they're guilty, right?
Right.
Because here's a public who's not necessarily educated on this particular issue, which is false confession, which is one of the leading, you know, causes of wrongful conviction. So when someone says that they're guilty of a crime, albeit falsely, the first inclination is to say, well, you know what? If he didn't commit this crime, as Kim was just saying, if he didn't commit this particular crime, why would he confess? But what doesn't happen and what doesn't occur in these particular situations is that what happens in the precinct when the cameras are not on, okay, and what happens in precincts when the cameras are not on is the physical altercations that occur in some cases, you know, the psychological abuse that occurs in cases. Okay, for example, in New York State, they're allowed to get away with, so to speak, they're allowed to actually get away with letting you know or saying to you, an innocent suspect, a young suspect like myself and Willie Stuckey, is that someone said that you committed a crime, okay?
Right.
So, in other words, what they really do is they lead you into the confession, potentially, without having to justify the position as to how they got there. And that's what happens with young suspects like Willie Stuckey and I. We were hoodwinked for, or at least to some degree, into saying or believing that this is actually what happens. Notwithstanding, the reality of not what happened was Willie Stuckey and I didn't commit this particular crime. But when circumstances are read to you in which the way they are, along with the sort of psychological interrogations that occur, one would believe, especially during the young suspects like Willie Stuckey and I, who were both 16 years old, we somehow lose track of what really happened. So we substitute reality for a fallacy. But the fallacy is that we were promised also that if we confessed against the other in terms of one witnessing the crime of the other, we will be allowed to go home. So I think what the public has to rationalize is who, in their right state of mind, wouldn't say, for example, that Willie Stuckey or David McCallum committed a crime in order to be released from incarceration or, you know, at the very least, confinement. And that's what happened. That's one of the other elements of this case that somehow sometimes gets lost in the equation. And that's pretty sad, too, because that is the crux of why someone like Willie Stuckey and David McCallum was ultimately convicted of this particular crime.
Now, were you defended at all? Like you said, you had a paid-for attorney. Did they just allow you guys to do these kind of confessions, or was this done beforehand?
Well, I want to clarify one thing that you just mentioned. Our attorneys were not paid for. They were what they call 18B attorneys. So, for example, they were court-appointed attorneys. So their obligation, for the most part, at least in my opinion, of course I'm looking at this in hindsight, was not to investigate or not to defend this case in the best of their ability. It was their position was defend this case in the best of their ability, right?
Right.
And that means giving us the most adequate representation as required by the New York State Constitution. And which they, I guess, did. But and when you're dealing with a murder case, for example, there's so many different variables that are involved with this. That's not only legal representation, but investigations, interviewing particular witnesses, going to the alibi witnesses, speaking to them, and those sorts of things. And those things were not really done in this particular case, you know? So I think what happens is when we look at 18B attorneys, for example, which I had an 18B attorney, Peter Murdo, we weren't given the sort of representation that I felt like this case deserved. And as a result, in the end, we also may pay for that.
Yeah,
I could add something.
Yeah.
First of all, David never met this attorney until the day of the trial. He was never basically given any kind of briefing, the attorney. The attorney himself was 71 years old. He had, I think, a half a dozen other similar serious cases, all of which I think the district attorney knew they were going to win because he was such an incompetent lawyer. But as well, he was under investigation during this time by the bar for stealing and lying to clients. After the trial, he was in fact disbarred. So this is an attorney who's representing a 16-year-old kid on a murder charge. And David not only had two hands behind his back, but tied behind his back, but he was being hit over the head with an anvil. So there was no hope that he was going to get off on this charge. Willie's lawyer was somewhat better, but Willie's lawyer didn't do any work on the case either.
Right. Right. I think that's sort of what I was referring to, and not that they were like these free attorneys, but a lot of them get appointed to these cases, but it's not their most important thing to do.
All they're doing is making a living.
Right.
That's it?
Yeah.
The case itself, the individual case itself, it's almost irrelevant.
Yeah. And that's kind of the... How do you feel, David, about the justice system now? At this point in your life, if someone was to say to you, is justice fair in the U.S., how would you respond?
Well, so my response would be, you know, in terms of the criminal justice system, in terms of whether it's fair or not, I would say it depends, right? It depends on the individual, right? So if you're an individual who has the resources to, let's say, for example, you know, hire a competent attorney, which, believe it or not, it really, really helps in the court of law, whether it's through reputation or legal maneuvering, that sort of thing. I think it's important that you have proper legal representation, at least someone who's going to fight for you to the very end. So, you know, for example, like someone like me who couldn't afford legal representation, I had to rely on court-appointed assistance, right? Right. It's not that, and that's not necessarily all, you know, what it's cracked up to be, as maybe the public would believe, because sometimes what these court-appointed attorneys do is they do what they would call the bare minimum. And the bare minimum is representing someone who is doing as much as they can, but as little as they can at the same time, while making sure they satisfy the legal requirements of the New York State Constitution and the federal Constitution. So that's what some of these court-appointed attorneys do. So as someone like me, as far as the system in general is concerned, I would like to believe that we have a fair criminal justice system. But again, reality doesn't necessarily dictate that based on circumstances and based on my past and previous history. So I would have to say that I'm sort of a mix. I don't mean to be sort of in the gray areas as far as that's concerned, but I'm sort of a mixed bag in terms of describing the criminal justice system as it presently constituted.
How was it for you and your family? You spoke about your mother. Did your family and everybody stick behind you, and did you have friends, or did they sort of kind of not believe you, or where did it stand?
So for me, look, there's approximately 55,000, at least at the time of my exoneration, there are approximately 55,000 inmates in the New York State Department of Correction, okay? So I'd like to say that me personally, I was one of the most fortunate ones, only because I had my family that supported me from the very beginning until the very end. And so, for instance, my mom, for example, during my arraignment of this particular crime, she had asked me one question. She had asked me, she said, "David, did you commit this crime?" I said, "No, Ma, I did not." And that question never came up again. So as a result, and knowing that I had my mom in my corner, that, you know, at least provided for me a sense of relief, knowing that my mom, the very person who I had to somehow convince that I didn't commit this particular crime, believed in the fact that I didn't. And so that was very huge for someone like me, and I appreciated that. So what that particularly did moving forward is it catapulted me into a position where I eventually knew that, you know what, my mom believed in me. So no matter what happens here on out, not necessarily that I will be fine with it, but I would know that my mom believed in what I had to say to her, and she believed in the fact that I told her that I did not commit this particular crime, and she respected that, and she believed me, and that was important to me.
Yeah, I'd say it would be. Ken, so how did the exoneration happen? How did you get it to Ken Thompson, who was the DA at the time? How do you make someone aware, a district attorney, and also make them believe and take on the case and help you through it? Because there's so many of these out here, and they've got so much of a job to do as it is. How did it work for you?
Well, that's a huge question. That's actually taken up in book Freeing David McCallum. But at the same time, remember that Ken Thompson was he only won office, the district attorney's office, in 2013, and we started with David's case in 2004. So Ken Thompson was the last step. All the way in between, there were two basic elements. One was to follow the legal trail. And in that, we had Oscar Michelin from New York, from Cuomo LLC. We had Steve Drizin, one of the most famous wrongful conviction people in the United States, from Northwestern, and Laura Cohen, who worked at Rutgers. These were top-flight people, and the reason they were on this case was that Reuben Hurricane Carter was so highly respected and raised so much money for innocence projects all over. So the second level, or the second thing that you have to have going for you, is publicity. But with Reuben, he could call a press conference. He was constantly going around giving speeches and being seen, and he could mention things. But his worry was that if you didn't get media in a really well-coordinated effort, that it was more than one or two stories, then all that media stuff would be wasted. And so we started putting together things that would pay off down the line, not just one TV appearance that David had early on with My 9 News in New York. It was a great thing. It was about 2005, maybe 2006 at the latest. It really was an effective piece, but it just was frittered away, the power of it, because nothing followed up with it. So we learned that lesson. And by the time David was on the verge of being released from prison, and I would say this began around the year 2012-13, more and more stories were coming out, the New York Times, the Daily News, and there was a sense, we had a sense now that any time we wanted to get a story out there, we would be able to do that. And at the same time, the legal process was advancing. We had so many setbacks, so many. We would go into court thinking we had such a phenomenal 440, which is the kind of bringing a motion to court to reopen the case. Oh, we thought we had such great stuff. And the judge who was ruling on the case was completely prejudiced against us. You had to be willing to, like David, to face setbacks, and you had to take your anger and express it and then just go on and keep going. So, again, you had the legal and the publicity, and each case is different. I wish it was a formula, but it's not. That's the way David's case worked.
And so, and what's your opinion now, 'cause working on that side of it, of helping people that are convicted innocently or by false confessions, what's your take on the justice system in the U.S.?
It's a very big question, and I think there are really good people everywhere in all aspects of the system, whether they be judges, prosecutors, defense attorneys, police. The trouble is that there are some rogue people, rogue prosecutors, and fairly cruel judges, and police who we know resort to violence and a number of other unsavory tactics. The problem is not that we have wrongful convictions, because they have to happen. It's just a mathematical certainty that out of so many convictions, with 2.3 million people in the prisons right now, with so many convictions, there are going to be thousands of wrongful convictions. The problem is the system that is designed to prevent this and to overturn it. The entire appeal system, to me, is a rubber stamp. Most of these appeals courts really don't look closely at the case. They want to be able to say that it's a good conviction. And unless they're given stunning evidence, really sometimes impossible evidence, then they're not inclined to overturn, especially on constitutional issues. This to me is the worst part of the American justice system, that the Constitution of the United States is routinely ignored for the convenience of prosecutors and police who've done a bad job in having put a person wrongly behind bars for perhaps the remainder of his life.
So David, how do you feel now? How is life for you now that you're out? And what's going on for you?
Well, for me, life right now is obviously great. So when I'm sometimes asked this particular question, I have to sort of do a compare and contrast, right? So when I compare my life now as opposed to what it was during my incarceration, I have to take the latter. I mean, you know, I mean the former, that is. I have to say that my life is pretty substantial now, you know. But at the same time, it's not without any particular challenges. So there's always going to be challenges, I would say, because, you know, during that amount of time in prison, you would have to believe that one would sometimes somehow become what some would call institutionalized. And, you know, what I mean by that is having to rid yourself of some of the everyday prisons that I had to experience during the course of my time, you know. So when you, now that I'm out on the outside, it's hard to shake. But at the same time, I have no real complaints about that, only because it's an important issue for me to sort of overcome, or at the very least, continue to navigate all the problems and circumstances that I'm faced with today. So I've made a decision to do that, right? Because I know what the alternative feels like. It is not a very good feeling at all. And so for me, being on the outside, I have my complaints, obviously, but at the same time, I also understand, particularly when I do the compare and contrast as to what things were and how life were when I was incarcerated, I understand that there's a huge difference in terms of being incarcerated and being in what they want to call the free society. So for me, so when I had problems, for example, there's people that I can talk to, not necessarily on the telephone, as I did many times with Ken, Gary Dolan, my attorney Oscar Mishman, and so forth, Mary Ellen, obviously. Excuse me. But I was also able to, now I'm also able now to speak to people face to face. And that's a huge difference in terms of being incarcerated, where you're very, very limited.
Yeah. So what would
be... Let David tell you what he's doing in his life right now.
Sure, yes. Very good question. So, you know, what I'm doing now, for example, is I work for the Manhattan Legal Aid Society. So I work for the Juvenile Rights Division. And so some of the work that I do now is stemmed around young people, for example, foster care, and people and young children who's being neglected by their particular foster parents or biological parents and that sort of thing. So that's kind of work, you know, gives me comfort. And what I also do is I do public speaking. So one of the things that I promised myself that I would do, that I promised others, of course, if I was ever released from prison, that I would do public speaking. And the sort of public speaking that I would like to do and that I am doing currently is speaking about wrongful convictions, right? But also speaking about wrongful convictions in a way that also supersedes or encounters other issues that affect our society. So when I do these particular talks, whether it's at juvenile rights detention centers, I just speak to lawyers, for example, in the criminal defense field, I get a sort of satisfaction because I feel like, not necessarily that I'm fulfilling a promise that I made to many others, and of course, including myself, but it's also making sure that I understand and I express to people and that don't have a voice at the particular moment that I let them know that there are people you know, who are suffering in our society, who needs to be heard. And I feel like in some ways, I'd like to think, at least, that I speak for these people.
And David, what would be the thing that you would tell someone that's young, who's having problem with the justice system, the legal system, or they've gotten in trouble? What's the thing you tell them?
Well, I would tell them that, you know, life is never over. I mean, sometimes we look at some of the bad deeds that we do or may not do or may that we are falsely accused of doing, but that's not the very end. I believe in redemption. I think redemption is very important to particularly someone like me. And one of the examples that I can use is there was many times that I could have given up on myself and my circumstances based on what I was being charged with, based on what I was faced with in terms of being in prison for the rest of my very life, natural life, that is. So I would say to people like that, no matter what the circumstances are, when things look bleak, there's an opportunity, how bleak it may seem, but there is an opportunity. And sometimes that's all we really need is the opportunity to express ourselves in a way to get somebody's attention. So for someone like me to be able to get the attention of Ken Klonsky, which in my opinion facilitated this whole process in terms of my path to freedom, that can't be overlooked, and it certainly can't be taken for granted, because those are in some ways, the missed opportunities that we have or that we don't take advantage of that end up costing some people sometimes not necessarily their natural life, but their literal life. So the example here is to not take anything for granted and to explore every option that you possibly can to make sure that you give yourself an opportunity to get a fair result. Right. And that's what I like to think I did in my situation.
Do you have any leftover anger from being put away to the, you know, for the officers that did it back in the 80s?
Well, I think for me, anger can be associated in many different ways. I mean, I don't blame someone for being very angry about what happened to them, him or her, for example, because they are all women who unfortunately are wrongfully convicted as well, who don't get the notoriety that I think their particular cases deserve. But I think for someone like me to be angry would be absolutely a waste of time, right? And the reason why it would be a waste of time for someone like me is I'm in my late 40s now, and I was in my mid-40s when I was exonerated. And for me to harbor that sort of grievance, because sometimes if we don't channel our anger properly, we can end up doing something that we will truly regret later on. So I was never going to put myself in that position. So what I did when I was in prison, for example, I decided to use my anger in a positive way. So whether that was helping other prisoners with work, legal work, or whatever the case may be, that's what I wanted to decide to do. And I was very determined about this, I did not want these people to think, when I say these people, I'm talking about the system in general, to think that, you know, whether this is not the person that they think I am, all right? Because I'm a better person than what they were falsely accusing me of doing, right? And that was my motivation. And my also motivation was my family, you know, who stood behind me from the very beginning until the very, very end. And I will always appreciate that. So that's, you know, I found motivation from many different angles of life. And I could not describe this any better than what, you know, the motivation was with my older sister, who is disabled, who has been bedridden her entire life. So whenever things got bad in prison for someone like me, I always knew there was someone on the outside, my sister, who was going through some stuff that she didn't particularly ask for, that, you know, that was an inspiration for me to continue to fight what I believed in.
So, Ken, so if people want to get involved and help out and contribute something for the cause of helping with false confessions or wrongly convicted people, what do you suggest?
Well, I would like to just say in parting there with David, he's a father, which is a huge thing. He's got a beautiful little daughter, Quinn, so I just wanted to put the plug in there because to say so, but I'm sure that's the most important thing in his life right now, or she's the most important thing.
No doubt.
Yeah. As to getting involved, I think someone in a particular area, if you know somebody who's dealing with a wrongful conviction, if there's someone in your family, if there's someone amongst your friendship group, if you know someone in the area that and you want to show concern, you can always contact the people who are running the show around that person and volunteer help. We're getting a lot of that right now on the Burns Raffet case, more so than I even know what to do with. But these people pledged money, and they've also pledged work, labor, and those are the people in the end who will get you out of prison. And you, as a volunteer, can participate in what I think is second to childbirth, perhaps the most wonderful experience in society, and that is to help someone's life be reborn back into society. It's certainly, there's nothing wrong. You can't say a negative thing about work like that if you're working on the right side and you're working for the truth. So there are many ways of getting involved, and it just depends on where you are and who you know.
Right. Well, Ken, this has been amazing. And David, the book, of course, is called Freeing David McCollum. And I want to thank you both for being on the show. And David, thank you for sharing with us some of your story.
Oh, wow, thank you. It's been my pleasure to do so, because I think for me, during the conclusion of my incarceration, I made a promise to myself and other prisoners who I left behind that when I ever got the opportunity to get out of prison, that I would try to create a platform for their particular voices to be heard in ways that they cannot do for themselves. And I'd like to think that I've accomplished that and will continue to accomplish that. So, for example, I know that Ken, for example, just mentioned, the Rafay Burns case. And I had the privilege, actually, of meeting Atif Rafay in person and having the opportunity to sit down and speak to him for a few hours was sort of like a sort of lifelong dream for someone like myself, because here it is. You're dealing with someone else who's being falsely accused of a crime and wrongfully convicted, who case involves what they would call a false confession. And I would say to the audience, for example, anytime we hear false confessions, it's an international issue. So here I am in the United States, for example, and Mr. Rafay is in, the state of Washington. And, this is an international problem. And if it's not a problem, involving one segment of North America, it actually involves the entire North America, and the Rafay case is a perfect example of that. So I just want to make sure that I bring, at the very least, mention the fact that there are many, many individuals like Rafay, like Atif Rafay, who are suffering in prison for crimes they didn't commit. And I think it's important for the society to understand that, again, based on what we talked about earlier, about when we hear the word confessions, the automatic assumption is that the person committed the crime. But I think when we take a very closer examination of the particular case or the confessions in general, or specifically, we will, I guess, come to the determination that that is not the fact, of what happened. So yeah. I think that's important for all of us to understand. Thank you.
It totally is. Well, thank you both again.
Thank you, Al.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Al Warren.
Welcome to Stephen's True Crime Commentary, a weekly radio discussion of forensics and true crime interest.
Welcome back. This is Stephen's True Crime Commentary, and of course I am Stephen David Lampley. Listen, I want to share something with you that's it's pretty amazing. Something Weird Media, which is one of the production companies that produces my commentary, has told me that my commentary is being very well received by everyone. Lots of good comments and a ton of listeners and a bunch of people downloading the segments, and I want to say thank you so much. I really appreciate that. If you would also do me a favor, if you like my commentary, if you would go to the House of Mystery True Crime Facebook page. If you would just go to Facebook and up at the top, just enter in House of Mystery True Crime, it'll come up. And leave me a message on the page somewhere, whether it's on one of my commentaries or just in general conversation, and let me know what you like about the commentary and what you're getting out of it, if anything. Give me some feedback. Let me know. I appreciate that so much. Also, I appreciate everyone that's telling your families and friends. Some of you have said that you're sharing this every day, and I really appreciate that too. Thank you. It's what keeps this commentary going. It's what keeps the radio program going, and we really appreciate your support. All right, now last commentary, we discussed ballistics as it pertains to internal ballistics, and of course, internal ballistics being the first stage. The stages, of course, are internal, transitional, external, and terminal. Now, in this commentary, we're going to cover transitional and external. Now, these ballistic phases have to do with the bullet after it leaves the gun barrel and before it hits the target. Now also, if you'll go to my webpage, we have a handout that goes along with this. You go to StephenDavidLampley.com/handouts, plural, handouts. It's a PDF. You can follow along with us online, or you can print it out. We've specifically made it printer friendly, so the margins should work. And it's also calibrated for black and white printers if you don't have color. So we've made sure it's printer friendly for you. StephenDavidLampley.com/handouts. All right, now one thing I need to go back on for last week, we talked about internal ballistics. Just a real quick side note. I needed to go over with you what makes up a primer. Now, in a primer, you have three elements. You have antimony, lead, and barium. With the exception of some primers may also contain some mercury. But now these primers that contain mercury are typically manufactured and found in Eastern Europe. Now, of course, we're going to discuss gunshot residue a lot more in depth in our next commentary. Matter of fact, we may spread that over two commentaries because there's a lot to cover. There's some pretty neat stuff that you may want to know about gunshot residue and forensics. So we're probably going to be spending a couple of segments on that. Okay, the first we're going to talk about is transitional ballistics. And transitional ballistics has to do with the ballistics involved once the bullet has instantly left the barrel and until all of the gases that were inside the gun have equalized. Now, when the bullet exits the gun, we talked in internal ballistics that there was between 30 and 40,000 pounds per square inch of pressure in that gun. Of course, that's what pushes the bullet out. But when that bullet comes out, the pressure is going somewhere. It's going in all different directions. Now, the fact that the gases are escaping in such a violent force, along with the fact that the bullet is exiting the gun and creating a sonic boom, that is the sound that you hear when a gun is fired. All right, now we're going to shift over to external ballistics, which is, of course, where transitional ballistics end, and external ballistics continue on until the bullet strikes its target. Now, there's three factors that influence a bullet once it has left the gun, and that is drag, just by the sheer fact that the bullet is traveling through space, it encounters a drag because there's atmosphere there. The second force it may encounter is wind, typically a side-to-side factor, and then, of course, the third factor would be the gravitational push for the bullet to go down. Now, if you have a gun, and let's say you're firing from some distance, where this doesn't apply so much up close, but if you're firing from a distance and you have a gun, be it a handgun or a rifle, and you're aiming down the barrel, again, now you have no sight, you're aiming down the barrel at the target, if you fire that gun from a distance, you're probably not going to hit the target. You can aim at that target all day long, but you're probably not going to hit it. Why is that? Again, because you've got drag, wind, and gravity affecting that bullet. Now, what a sight does on a gun is it causes the barrel to rise up. Once the gun is sighted in, it causes the gun barrel to rise up. And by doing so, it creates a trajectory or a path for that bullet that will actually go higher. The bullet will actually travel higher than the target. And then the gravitational forces and the drag will bring it back down so that when it arrives at the target, it will hit part of the target that you have aimed at. Okay, our time is up today. We will come back for the next two sessions and we'll be discussing gunshot residue. Okay, in ending, I want to tell you something. We have a new seminar available on how to catch a liar, and it's phenomenal. I'm sorry if I do say so myself. It's really cool. If you've always wanted to be able to tell if someone's lying to you, you really probably need to take advantage of this seminar. If you've ever been wanting to learn, here's your chance. We're going to talk about a lot of different things in the class. Some of the things we're going to talk about are going to be global versus individual indicators, eye shift. We'll talk about contractions, tense switching, question pause, and so much more. There's no way I could go over everything that we're going to talk about here in the short time we have on this commentary. Also, I'd like to ask you to go to my book page on Amazon. I have an author's page on Amazon. It's amazon.com/author/Stephen Lampley. amazon.com/author/Stephen Lampley. And getting back to the Catch a Liar, if you want information on that, just simply go to my website, stephendavidlampley.com. And click on the How to Catch a Liar icon. It'll take you right to that page. All right. Well, it's been great. I've enjoyed it. And we will see you again next time. We'll talk about gunshot residue. And thank you so much. Have a great day. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening into Stephen's True Crime Commentary, your true crime source. Stephen's Commentary is a production of Something Weird Media and West 53rd Productions. Music by JasonLandblue.com.
To find out more about our show, guests, or listen to a previous show, visit our website at www.somethingweirdmedia.com.
The mission has been completed.
The end!
By George, he's got it! It is the end!
I'll see you.
If you're lying to me, I'll be back.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.